might mention even before I start that, you know, the Institute has a question-answer service. Floy Lilly is the one that fields questions that come in from all over the world about Austrian this and Austrian that, or sometimes Keynesian. And the one that just came in that she showed me this morning was from a financial planner at a large company. I won't mention names, but and it's just a one-liner here. I'm a financial planner and would like to learn simply the key differences between Austrian and Keynesian economics. That's what he wants to learn. So too bad he's not here today, because that's what this lecture is all about. I'm going to try to get it down to the basics about what's the difference between those two schools. And do a little more than that, actually. Let me find the clicker here and we'll see how it goes. Should be Hayek and Keynes, right there with their birth and death years. And I call this Keynes and Hayek head-to-head. And one of the reasons I say head-to-head is because there was some back and forth actually between Keynes and Hayek that took the form mostly of their reviewing one another's books, with Hayek reviewing Keynes's early book, The Treatise on Money. Hayek never reviewed the general theory, but he reviewed the treatise on money, and Keynes responded to it, but rather than respond to his review, he simply wrote a very nasty review of Hayek's Prices and Production. And a little bit of ill will created there. They went back and forth several times, but it was more of a brawl, I think, than a debate. And they never did quite get head-to-head to figure out what the differences were. But I'll show you here today, they're easier to put head-to-head than you actually imagine. There they are right there, head-to-head. But after the debate, or brawling, or whatever it was, Hayek pretty much despaired and eventually pretty much got out of what he called technical economics and began writing about political economy, road to serfdom, and Constitution of Liberty and that sort of thing. Although in his later years, he still believed the things he wrote about the Austrian theory of the business cycle, but that was well after Keynes had died, of course. Okay, let me first set out the basic differences in terms of vision and frameworks. It was Schumpeter who talked a lot about vision, and he wasn't making reference to a burning bush or anything like that, but just pointing out that economists and other theorists generally have some vision in their mind before they get the analytics and go after it in a nutsy-boltsy sort of way. So I just have a couple of statements here that will contrast Keynes and Hayek on these grounds. Keynes's vision of the economy suggests a circular flow. And of course, if you've all taken beginning macro, you've seen that circular flow in which earning and spending are brought into balance by changes in the level of employment, which is also changes in the level of income. So the economy can spiral up and spiral down as with the spending and income. Contrast that to Hayek's vision of the economy suggests a means-ends framework in which the means of production are transformed over time into consumable output. So that you can see that structure of production, that triangle right there. So if you want sort of an iconic representation of the two schools, Keynes is a circle, a circular flow, and Hayek is the triangle. If you look at the actual graphical analysis that gets used. Graphically, this is for Keynes. The circular flow appears as a Keynesian cross. How do you get from a circle to a cross? We'll see that shortly. The cross's intersection identifying the particular state of the economy in which income and expenditures are in balance. That should ring true if you've taken the intro courses. With Hayek, graphically, the means and ends appear as a Hayekian triangle. The triangle's shape depicting the intertemporal pattern of investment. Then in equilibrium, the pattern of investment corresponds to the intertemporal preferences of consumers. So very different visions of the two economists. So I'll start now with a brief rendition of the Keynesian circular flow, with apologies to all of you who have suffered through this sort of analysis. This is the kind of analysis you would have seen as early as 1948 in Samuelson's initial macroeconomic text, or principles text, which separated microeconomics from macroeconomics. So it goes like this. At a circular framework here. And upstairs I write in that square up there, business organizations, that's sort of a shell where different people, factor owners and consumers, workers get together. And down below I'll put the participants here. You got workers, you got consumers, you got investors, all of which meet at the firm and make deals and so on. Well, the circular flow goes like this, that you have a flow of labor. In other words, workers are working for these businesses. It says labor and other factor services, but Keynes focuses almost predominantly on labor, and the workers get paid for it. It's called income. It goes like that, okay? If you have any sense of symmetry, that's just half the story, isn't it? If you look on the other side, you've got goods and services that are produced at the firm and fall into the hands of consumers, but guess what? They have to pay for it, and that's the expenditures, like so, all right? Now, that's a little prettier circular flow, I think, than in the textbooks. I'm going to introduce the interest rate, but only as a policy tool by the government. In fact, that's all the more true in the modern age, where the Federal Reserve has essentially hijacked the interest rate, which should be a market phenomenon, but they've hijacked it for use as a policy instrument. My circular flow actually circulates, okay? Well, it's a little sluggish. Well, no wonder. Look, the Fed has set the interest rate at 6%. Of course it's sluggish. If you just lower the interest rate, you make that sucker go. Okay? When it was sluggish, of course, there was some unemployment going on, and so you speed it up a little bit. And now guess what? There's inflation going on. Well, we can fix that too. You just change the interest rate back to 6%. Okay, and it goes like that. Well, that's a circular flow, and that's what gives rise to the Keynesian cross, and we'll see how that goes next. Okay, there's Keynes. And what we're going to do here, eventually, in fact, throughout the hour, is cause the Keynesian framework to morph into the Austrian framework. See what's needed to make the change from Keynes to Hayek. And that will show you exactly what the differences are in the two schools of thought. And, of course, with Hayek, you have a structure of production, and it can change shapes, as we've learned. You've got goods in process going through the different stages, and we can change shapes with changes in the interest rate. And so there's a huge difference between the circle and the triangle, and we want to see what that difference is as we go through this lecture. I'll use a wholly private economy here, in which income needs to equal expenditures to be in equilibrium. That's the Keynesian prescription, Y, which is income, equals E, which is expenditures, for a wholly private economy. I've learned in my sophomore classes at Auburn that when I said wholly private economy, I actually had to spell it out, W-H-O-L-L-Y, because otherwise the students would think of it as wholly, H-O-L-Y, the wholly private economy. No. It just doesn't have a government sector, that's all. And so income has to equal expenditures, which is made up exclusively of consumption expenditures and investment expenditures. If it were a mixed economy, if it had government involved, then you'd be C plus I plus G. That probably can roll off your tongue if you've had that introductory course, okay? Now, we go to the cross, and yet the two axes, one is expenditures and one is income, and what you know that is they have to be equal if the economy is in equilibrium. Well, how do you say that they're equal? Graphically, you just draw a 45-degree line. So it's only along that 45-degree line that consumption plus investment expenditures equals income, all right? Now all we have to know is something about consumption expenditures, and you've learned that the more people earn, the more they spend. Your father didn't have to tell you that. You knew it to start with. And that they spend something, even if temporarily they're not earning an income. That's the vertical intercept. And so that consumption equation looks like that. A vertical intercept, A, how much you spend if you're not earning an income, plus some proportion of your income, which is less than one. You don't hoop it all off. Oh, some of you do. But overall, people will spend less than their actual income, which just means they save some, even if not very much. Okay, so A is the intercept, B is the slope. Okay, you've got it. And on top of that, we add investment. Now, here's the point that came from this morning's talk, is that investment doesn't depend on anything. It just is what it is. It's based on animal spirits. And the only reason that line slopes upward is because it's piled up on top of consumption. So I really is the investment, is the vertical distance between consumption and investment. All right? Well, these things are separated in Keynesian theory mainly because of their stability properties, where consumption is fairly stable. It doesn't move around much. Although we'll see an instance later where it does move, it doesn't move around much, and investment is unstable. It's moving all the time, up and down, although I'm not showing that here, okay? Government spending is then viewed as the stabilizing component. If investment's unstable, government spending moves just in the opposite direction as investment, and the whole economy will be stable. That's the Keynesian notion. That's the basis for policy prescription of spending. Okay, and then where that cross happens, where C plus I intersects the 45-degree line, that's the equilibrium level of income. And you notice we've calculated that, or we've shown that, independent of prices, wages, interest rates, or any of the market mechanisms that Hayek would focus on. And so equilibrium, then, is just an equilibrium between income and expenditures. Wages are taken to be pretty much sticky or fixed. They are what they are. And prices are sticky, too. And the interest rate is wholly out of play here. It doesn't even affect investment. Doesn't affect saving, according to Keynes. All right, that just shows you graphically that income is equal to consumption plus investment, which means Y equals E, expenditures, and the economy is in equilibrium. Not that that's full employment, it might not be. But we're going to start, as you'll see in a minute, assuming that that happens to be full employment. According to Keynes, it's only by accident or design that the economy is performing at its full employment potential. What's left out? Accident or design or what? Well, the invisible hand, the forces of the marketplace. That's not going to do us any good. It's only by happen so or because the government made it happen by adjusting government spending one way or the other, or by pumping in money to the right amount. Okay, that's what he had in mind. We assume here that initially full employment conditions prevail if only by accident. So we'll give Keynes that. We'll spot him. We start off at full employment and then see what sort of things happen. Now, one way that, in fact, the way the Austrians, or at least the way I, would show that there's full employment is see how this looks on the PPF. Now I've got consumption there on that axis and investment on the vertical or on the horizontal axis, and I can just trace over here from consumption. You see where the consumption line is, and that much consumption, you have that much investment. And if those two things are equal, they're visually they don't look quite equal, but they're intended to be. I've just got a little longer scale here on the investment side, on the PPF side. But the fact that the economy is on its PPF means there's full employment. Okay? There it is. Now, that's what that says, operating on the production possibilities frontier. Now, Keynes would have a different way of doing it. He would look at this income and see what the supply and demand look like at that point. That looks just like a Marshallian diagram, supply and demand determine wages. He doesn't interpret it that way. Keynes interprets it this way. We have a supply of labor, and there it is, that upward sloping line, that's the supply of labor. And we have, guess what, a going wage. That's a Keynesian expression. We have a going wage. So the supply curve is what it is. The wage rate is what it is. And the question is, does the demand for labor just happen to be crossing the supply curve at the going wage? Well, hey, we're lucky it does. Look, it just happens that the demand for labor crosses at that going wage. And so that's full employment, all right? That's what that says. But the interesting thing here, well, here it says we can measure income down here, at least it's a measure of labor income, just by multiplying the wage rate, W, times the number of worker hours supplied and demanded, that's N, to give you labor income. But Keynes argues as if total income moves directly in proportion with labor income. So he's not taking into account any difference in distribution of income as between labor and capital and land and so on. It's labor income. It's the biggest share of income anyhow, and it's pretty much proportional to income. So we can let labor income measure total income, or at least movements in labor income will mirror movements in total income. It's important to note there, in fact, well, I think I note it later, so I'll hold off. So I've labeled this Y sub FE. And FE, of course, if you're a chemist, means iron. But if you're an economist, it means full employment, okay? So that's the full employment level of income. Here I'll bring back the circular flow and notice that, yeah, E equals Y. I've got E here on the left side for some reason. And Y on the right side doesn't matter. So E equals Y. Yeah, we get that. And that's because of that intersection up there with the 45-degree line at full employment. Okay, so we're at equilibrium, not only at equilibrium, but also full employment. Now, I need to say something about investment. According to Keynes, a collapse in investment activity, the collapse being attributable to a waning of the animal spirits. This is in one of his late chapters of the book. In fact, it's Notes on the Business Cycle or whatever that chapter is called. That's the primary cause of economic downturns. In other words, instead of seeing some distortion going on to cause a bust, he just sees the bust happening because business people got cold feet for some reason. Okay? They lost the fire in the belly. They were moved by the animal spirits to invest less. That's what starts it, according to him. In response to the reduced investment and hence reduced employment opportunities, the economy spirals downward into recession and possibly into deep depression. I don't have an axis here for animal spirits or Okay. That would cool any investor's heels right there, you know. Something bad is happening. And so they lose the fire in the belly and investment falls. And it looks like that. And in fact, look simultaneously on the circular flow and you see that now expenditures are less than investment. Well, if expenditures are less than investment, I'm sorry, less than income. Income is being earned by people producing goods. And expenditures aren't buying all those goods. So the goods are just piling up at the level of the firm, and that's excess inventories. I think we can get some measure of excess inventories over there, and there they are. Excess inventories are building up at the firm level. And so what happens? The economy crashes. Watch it crash. Okay? So it moves down to that level. And all of a sudden now we don't have full employment. First, you can see that investment came down by that vertical amount up there. Income went down by that horizontal amount. And one thing that you have to do if you take this intro course is calculate the ratio between delta I and delta Y. It's called the investment multiplier. And I won't do the derivation for you. You can probably do it yourself. But the multiplier here is 1 over 1 minus B. So however much investment falls, income falls by a multiple of that, and the multiple is 1 over 1 minus B. B is the slope of the line, so it might be 0.8, 0.9. If it's 0.8, then 1 minus B is 0.2, and 1 over 0.2 is 5. So income would be falling about 5 times as fast as investment spending. But also notice that consumption falls. Not that the equation falls, but that you move along an upward sloping line, and so you have less consumption. And even right here, we see investment and consumption are moving in the same direction. They're not trade-offs one with the other. They're moving in the same direction. There they are. All right? Now, if you look at the labor situation, you see that the wage rate hasn't changed because wages are sticky downwards. But the demand for labor has, because the people aren't spending so much now. Then you don't have to hire so many workers to produce what people are willing to buy. All right? And here's what is interesting to note. Keynes talks about the going wage. Note that the going wage keeps going even after the market conditions that gave rise to it are gone. Now, you have to think about that. Really? Is that the way it works? And another thing you have to think about is when you look at this whole diagram, this is the general theory. He called his book The General Theory. How general is it? It's a theory of a hamstrung economy, okay, where market forces aren't working, ruled by animal spirits. Okay, that's not a general theory. By the way, it's real clear that he named his book really not because of actual generality of the theory. He named it because he cribbed the name from Einstein's book, The General Theory of Relativity. Einstein was a fan of Keynes, and Keynes was a fan of Einstein. And so he wanted to name his book in a way that suggested that his theory of macro did for economics what Einstein's theory of relativity did for physics. Don't think it did that, but that's what he thought. Okay. Now I have an opportunity to skip some slides, and especially looking at the clock, I know that I better do that. So I'm going to skip and go to a morphing of the circular flow to the means ends. If I had stayed on that track, the economy would have kept getting worse. So it's bad enough as it was. So we'll be morphing from the circular flow to the means ends framework. That's what we need to do now. Let's see if we can do it. Well, we haven't gotten anywhere so far. We've just got that same old diagram. And I'm going to put in play the PPF. And this time, we're going to use it to track the Keynesian movements in a Hayekian way. All right? And so we're going to let those same things happen now. I think I'll save you from the animal spirits, but investment's going to fall. And you can see what's going to happen. Let's see if we're at full employment. Happened to be. Good. Now we have a waning of the animal spirits that cause investment to decrease, and with it, income and consumption. The economy falls inside the PPF. So you could look at the left side of this diagram and see that investment schedule fall, the thing moved down the 45-degree line to a new equilibrium. Well, what's more important is what's happened with the PPF, okay? There's the investment falling. Now watch what happens. Well, we go inside the PPF. We knew that anyhow because we saw before that when investment went down, so did consumption. Well, if that's true, you're inside the PPF, and there you're sitting, okay? And now, though, let's suppose that it falls even further. There you got the unemployment, just like before. And let's say now we have further waning that sends the economy into deeper depression. It almost eliminates investment, not quite. What do you think is going to happen now to these equilibrium points? Well, we're really got a high level of unemployment. That's there, okay? Wage rate still hadn't changed. It's sticky downwards. And over on the right, we're well inside the PPF. Now, if you pay attention to how this is set out, you get the idea that there's movements inside the frontier and beyond trace out a linear relationship. It turns out 3 points is enough to determine a straight line, I know, with one to spare, isn't that right? And so it'll trace out different possibilities of unemployment if you're inside the PPF, of full employment if you just happen by mere coincidence to be on the PPF, and outside the PPF, which now is just inflation. In other words, yeah, more income, but it's higher prices and higher wages and not actually more output. And so we can trace a line like that through those points. And that's the line on which the Keynesian economic system can move. It doesn't move around that PPF at all. It moves outside and inside the PPF, and only by the merest coincidence will it happen to be on the PPF. And if it is on the PPF, it's not likely to stay there for long because of the animal spirits. Okay, this is the Keynesian vision. And this is why you're desperate for policy actions from the fiscal authority and the monetary authority to do just the right things at just the right time to keep the economy on the PPF, fighting inflation and fighting unemployment to save the economy from these Keynesian forces. That's the idea. Note that investment were to fall to zero, the economy would settle into an income expenditure equilibrium at Y equals C. And I'll draw a line there, really, just a construction line to show you that sure enough, if it fell clear to zero in investment, then that would designate the intercept of that upward sloping line. Now, you've all seen these equations. When you take macro 101, the wholly private economy is in equilibrium when Y equals C plus I. And the consumption function is C equals A plus B. Now, suppose you know what I is. You know the magnitude of investment. And you know the parameters A and B. Well, you can solve for the equilibrium level of income. How many have had to do that on an exam? Okay, quite a few people. Did you get it right? Did you get it right? Get credit for it? I think what's more fun to do, and more unusual, in fact, highly rare, is use these equations in a different way. You got two equations and three unknowns, being C, I, and Y, three variables. So let's eliminate Y and solve for the relationship between C and I. And guess what? That will give you the equation of that upward sloping line. And you know, you can look at it later or just doodle it and work it out for yourself. But that's the equation. I'll put it upstairs here where you can see it better. The intercept turns out to be A over 1 minus B. The slope is B over 1 minus B. And so that's the equation. That's how consumption varies with investment. I say here somewhere, well, maybe a little later, here's where I say that Keynes worked us through an example. He simplified it even more. For simplicity, he let A equal zero. It's not zero, but he said, let's let A equal zero. And so the consumption in his example becomes C equals 0.9Y. That's B was 0.9 for Keynes. That's a real high marginal propensity to consume, but that's what he had. And C then, he works it out, and C ends up 9 times I. Okay, what does this mean? He says, if, for example, the public are in the habit of spending 9/10 of their income on consumption goods, it follows that if entrepreneurs were to produce consumption goods at a cost more than 9 times the cost of investment goods they're producing, some part of the output could not be sold at a price that covered the cost of production. So what he's saying is that we'd be off that upward sloping curve, and that can't happen. There'd have to be adjustment made to get back to the curve. This formula is, of course, not quite so simple as the illustration. That's right, because A is positive, it's not zero. But there's always a formula, more or less of this kind, relating the output of consumption goods, which it pays to produce, to the output of investment goods. This conclusion appears to me to be quite beyond dispute. Okay? In other words, he's saying this, C and I always have to move together. They can't move in the opposite direction. Yet the consequences which follow are at the same time unfamiliar in Keynes' day and of the greatest possible importance. They're unfamiliar because people weren't Keynesian until Keynes wrote this stuff. They're important because as soon as you realize it's true, then you need fiscal policy and monetary policy to save the economy from disaster. So this is a very revealing statement that he's making. Okay, now, one thing that I missed mentioning, you might have read it here, but that upward sloping line I wrote somewhere a slide or two ago is called the Keynesian demand constraint, okay? And I say is called the Keynesian demand constraint. I really should say I called it that. I called it that because no one else had called it anything. No one else had drawn the thing, all right? I challenge you to look at any intermediate or entry-level textbook or any graduate-level textbook which has that curve drawn and named and spelled out, okay? But I call it the Keynesian demand constraint. And what it implies is that PPF is out of play. That's why I made it dashed lines. It's out of play because the economy can only move up and down along that constraint, right? Now, to go further, we can carry along the graphics for the loanable funds market. And we'll see that we can see the significance of it in Keynes's book itself. So I'm going to draw it like I did this morning, supply and demand for loanable funds. And here we're back at full employment, so we just show it clearing the market for loanable funds. All right? Like so. Now, let's use our Keynesian example once again and let investment fall. And we'll see what happens. If investment falls, so does income. Isn't that right? So does income. And if income falls, saving falls. Okay. So when we say investment falls, we get to show that two different ways. That let me go ahead and show that, I think. Yeah, so you can see investment fell, that line up there drifted down like it has before. But also the demand for loanable funds fell because if you're not going to invest, you don't need to borrow the funds. Isn't that right? And if Hayek were here, he'd say, yeah, if that happened, then the interest rate would fall to reach a new equilibrium. But Keynes says, no, Hayek, that won't happen because before that can happen, something else happens. And guess what? The economy crashes, okay? The economy spirals down. And when the economy spirals down, income falls, and when income falls, guess what? Saving falls. You can't keep saving the same amount if you're earning less income. So when I pull the trigger now, we see the old results that we'd seen before, plus we see that the saving schedule shifts to the left. Just watch it. There it goes. Like so. And we're back to the Keynesian equilibrium. We've got unemployment. And Keynes would say that the loanable funds diagram is absolutely superfluous because the interest rate doesn't change. This is one of the reasons. He had several. Keynes argued like a lawyer. I don't know if you've heard about this, but Keynes had a number of arguments for a particular point that were not necessarily mutually consistent arguments. It's the old thing, do we have any, all of our law people are over with Napolitano, aren't they? So I can just tell you how lawyers argue without worrying about offending anybody. The lawyer says, my client didn't borrow your lawnmower, okay? And what did he say now? He didn't borrow your lawnmower. And it was already broken when you lent it to him. And it was still in perfect shape when he returned it. That's it. I got it. I got it straight. Thought I was going to blow it. That's arguing like a lawyer. Well, Keynes argued that the investment demand is straight up and down. It doesn't depend on the interest rate. And saving is straight up and down. It doesn't depend on the interest rate. But if you draw it this way, with it depending on both of them depending on the interest rate, then when those curves shift, they both shift at once, and it doesn't change the interest rate. Okay, so that's the way he argued. Now the amazing thing, and I only discovered this after I had done this part of the diagram, is that that one diagram in the general theory that Herod advised Keynes to put in, not only is this diagram, but is there to make this exact point. This is what Keynes says. All right, and let me show you. I can't resist. Well, I'm going the wrong way, no wonder. Okay, that is a page out of the general theory, and that's his diagram. Now, it doesn't quite look like our diagram, but I can show you how it is. First of all, those people here who are a little bit mathematical, a little bit graphically oriented, can anybody see something just wrong with that diagram from the start? Yeah? Pardon? The axis isn't labeled. Okay, I flunked sophomores for that, and Keynes didn't. Oh, it could have been his publisher that left it off, but he didn't label it. Now the horizontal axis he's labeled R, which stands for the interest rate. I forget what the British word for interest rate is. Actually, a rate of return is what he had in mind. Okay, which was common in the period. We won't fault him for that. So here R is the rate of return or interest rate. Though he failed to label the vertical axis, it's clear by the text that he meant investment. He said, or saving. He really meant investment and saving, because he's got them both plotted there. They're measured vertically. So we'll save Keynes from himself and put saving and investment. And so now our big problem is just the thing is turned cronkwise. And so you need to flip it over and then rotate it. But we can do that for him too. Okay? Like that. Now it's the same thing, so we got saving and investment on the horizontal axis, and I made it interest rate, call it rate of return if you want. Now his problem is that he's got them convex and concaved in the wrong direction. Well, we can't fix everything. We'll just have to put up with it, all right? It's kind of a busy diagram because some of those Y-labeled axes are simply to show that the saving depends on income, which is not on an axis. So income is a shift parameter. So what I want to do is eliminate those income labeled supply of savings that were just there to show there's a shift parameter. Okay, there they are. And now we're left with the bare bones. And if you look at it, squint at it, and again, apart from the convexity and concavity going the wrong way, it's the exact same diagram. And if you read the text, it's on page 180, is that what it says up there? You can see that exactly what he says is that, let me get there, if investment shifts to the left like that, that saving will shift to the left by the same amount so the interest rate doesn't change. That's his point. And that's why he wants to get rid of this whole, who needs it? Because the interest rate is determined by, as he says, forces of a different kind. It sounds kind of eerie, but, and it all has to do with the central bank and liquidity preference and all that. And so that diagram is just dead on the same that we've got in the other, in my graphics, and is used for the same point. So we can't be accused of not having Keynes straight. I can show it in the other diagram, but it's all cronkwise, so I don't emphasize that. Okay, so here we are again, back at this graph, which is, like I say, the same thing in Keynes. Now, Keynes also denied that an increase in saving would have the effect that Hayek thought. An increase in saving, rather than spur the economy on to grow faster, would cause the economy to fall into depression. Okay? And how does this work? Well, let me show you. This is his paradox of thrift. Let me back that up just for a minute, just to warn you. If you change the saving rate, that's going to affect almost every curve on the board, except the demand for loanable funds here. But an increase in saving means a decrease in consumption, isn't that right? So when saving goes to the right, consumption is going to go down. And C plus I is going to go down only because I is sitting on top of C, all right? And even the demand constraint is going to change because when C goes down, that changes the intercept of the consumption equation. That's the A term. And so the income constraint will reflect that. So now we'll let that happen. All that happens at once, and we have more saving. Now let's switch gears for just a second and say if Hayek were here, he would say, oh, okay, hold it right there, Keynes. If the supply of saving shifts outward, then that puts downward pressure on interest rates. Interest rates fall. Investors are willing to borrow more. And they'll undertake more investments, and especially in the early stages, so they'll have something to sell when people have saved up some money. So there. Okay. And what does Keynes say? He says, oh, Hayek, but before that happens, something else happens. Can you guess what it is? The economy crashes. Okay. The economy crashes. Hey, this one's not crashing. Okay. There it goes. The economy crashes. And when it crashes, then guess what? Saving shifts to the left. In other words, the saving shifted out because people wanted to save more. But then the economy crashes and they're earning less income, so they go back to saving less. All right? So it says you just can't make people save more, or if people want to save more, it's self-defeating, they'll end up saving less. And that's the paradox of thrift. He articulates it, to save more, you'll instead earn less. And again, the economy will be in the dumper. Now, what I want to do now is resolve this paradox of thrift as a way of morphing from Keynes to Hayek. And let me show you how that works. Let me clean up the diagram that we're back to square one, except we've got the PPF out of play. And notice that the level of consumption appears in this diagram as part of the circular flow. Right there, that's consumption. And if we were simply to replace that diagram with a Hayekian triangle, that would be the consumption end of the Hayekian triangle, wouldn't it? Like that, okay? We just put our Hayekian triangle in there, and then we'll get rid of that Keynesian cross apparatus, all right? But what I want to do is keep the Keynesian market mechanisms or market failures and assume a fixed structure of production. Triangle doesn't change in shape. That's what Keynes said. And actually, if you wanted to be a little bit kind to Keynes, the reason he said that is because he was thinking very short term. His macro is very short term macro. There's not enough time to change the structure of production. He's just talking about the level of employment with a given structure of production. So the structure of production is still fixed. And when he looks at labor, he has the labor market representing anywhere along that stages of production diagram. Doesn't matter whether you're early stage, late stage, and partly because it doesn't matter about interest rate because it doesn't change anyhow as a result of shifts in the supply and demand for loanable funds. So it looks like that. So the first thing we'll do in the market mechanisms in play here is still those as envisioned by Keynes, okay? In accordance to the paradox, an increase in saving causes the economy to spiral down to a less than full employment equilibrium. Well, we can see that it does, because let's watch it. Okay, so you get an increase in the supply of saving. You get a movement of the demand constraint. And that's it. You're not getting any adjustment in the interest rate. And so the economy crashes. And when it crashes, like so, then what you see is that the triangle is smaller, but it doesn't change in any way in the shape. And so with that smaller triangle, you don't need to employ so much labor, so you got the unemployment, right? So even if we adopt the framework, if we still keep the Keynesian assumptions about wage rates not changing, about interest rate being out of play, about the structure of production being fixed, it still works like a Keynesian economy, okay? So note that the sole effect on the structure of production comes from the initial reduction in consumption. The derived demand effect, that's the well-duh effect, works undiminished on all earlier stages. The interest rate is effectively out of play. The leftward shift in savings took the downward pressure off of interest rates. And in any case, the capital structure is assumed to be fixed. And that's it. Now, go back to that point. Keynesian view, I want to make three modifications in order to transform this Keynesian vision into the Hayekian vision. And what I want you to think about is, could anyone object to these three modifications? Or could even a mainstream economist object to any of the three? Or could a Keynesian object to any of the three? All right? One is we divide the structure of production into stages. Well, that's easy. Okay, let's put the different stages of production to limber them up so that it can work like Hayek claimed. And if you have different stages, then the labor market diagram doesn't apply to each and every stage in the same way. And so we have to get rid of this universal supply and demand for labor, and put in a stage-dependent supply and demand for labor. Well, we can do that. Get rid of the Keynesian one and put in the Austrian one. Okay, that's the second objection. And what's the third objection? The third modification, get rid of the Keynesian demand constraint. In fact, we can get rid of it because now, with the structure of production able to change shapes and with the labor markets able to move workers from one stage to another, then the PPF is back in play and we're no longer confined by the Keynesian demand constraint. So we can get rid of the Keynesian demand constraint. And I'm sorry, I don't have the sound on for some reason, but we can watch us do that. We just blow it up, okay? It's gone. All right. Well, now we've got the Austrian model. That's the Austrian model that we got just from using those three constraints. So the paradox of thrift becomes a gateway to growth, a little bit of hyperbole there, but that's fine. Okay, so with wage rates and interest rates both adjusting to changes in market conditions, the economy can move along the PPF and the structure of production can adjust to an increase in saving. And you can see that once again right here, an increase in saving, movement along the frontier, an adjustment of the stages of production, opposing movements in the demand for early stage and late stage. And you've got a market mechanism that makes the economy conform to consumer preferences and particularly to time preferences. And again, Hayek's summary description of just what was wrong with Keynes. Mr. Keynes' aggregates conceal the most fundamental mechanisms of change. And what we did is put those fundamental mechanisms back in there and let them work. And it gives us the Hayekian view. Not to play favorites here, but hey. Okay, that's it. Happy to answer. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem with aggregating. Almost any theory aggregates to some extent. It's a question of choosing the level of aggregation that allows you to make your points. Okay? So in other words, with the Hayekian case, you can say that the individual stages of production are not disaggregated. I didn't try to tell you half a dozen different things that are going on within a given stage. But I have a number of stages which captures the sorts of movements that give us insights into how that market works. Okay? So anything, even in microeconomic analysis, you can talk about the supply and demand for apples. But if what you're interested in is relative changes in the demand for these kind of apples as opposed to those kind of apples, you need to disaggregate. So you have to disaggregate to the point where you're picking up the mechanisms that you want to emphasize. And what Keynes did is he aggregated at such a high level that it simply eclipsed any of those mechanisms that might otherwise cause markets to work. And this kind of scheme disaggregates enough to show how they might work. Now, for microeconomic purposes, we'd have to disaggregate further. Or even if we wanted to separate out housing from other kinds of investment, we would disaggregate further. You just have to choose your aggregation scheme that's consistent with the theory that you want to construct. Okay? Yeah. Why? That's an interesting question. Why would people lose their cool? Or why would they? And the one thing that I remember seeing, it's one of these explanations. I found it in print somewhere, and I don't know where, and I haven't found anybody else that knows where, but I'll tell you the story, and you tell me. I mean, if any of you can find it, let me know. But the story was that Keynes was in a seafood restaurant in the lobby waiting for a table. And even back then, in seafood restaurants, they had an aquarium for people to watch the fish. So it wasn't invented by Red Lobster, you know, the aquarium thing. But and so Keynes was watching the fish, and they would be swimming this way for a while. And then well before they got to the end of the aquarium, they'd all turn and go back the other way. And then all turn again at the same time and go the other way. And Keynes looked at that, and he was just sort of mesmerized by it, and finally said, "That's just like investors. That's the way investors work. They're either all optimistic or they're pessimistic, and they change from one to another without any noticeable reason for their changing." Okay? So I guess the answer to that question is, no, he really argued backwards. In other words, look, we saw the economy come crashing down on itself, and we didn't see anything that could possibly have caused that, meaning that he wasn't privy to the mechanisms that Hayek was. So it must have been that people just turned pessimistic. Anybody else? Yes. I'll get you in a minute. Liquidity preference, especially in the general theory, but it shows up in textbooks too. You know, liquidity has a common meaning in finance, by which we can say some things are more liquid than others. All right. With Keynes, he used the term liquidity to be synonymous with money, as if money is the only liquid thing. Of course, it's the most liquid thing, because definitionally, liquidity has to do with how easily you can convert it into money. Well, if you've got money, hey, it's a snap, you know. But he took money to be liquidity, and everything less liquid than money was not liquidity, all right? And even in his examples, he would compare liquidity, that's money, with a long-term bond. And the longest of long-term bonds in Britain, they had consols, they were called consols, that never matured. You just got interest payment from now on and willed it to your offspring and so on. And so he's gotten from the most liquid to the least liquid in terms of interest rate exposure. And develops his theory that way. Well, if those polar cases are the only two possibilities, then those movements are pretty wild and they're pretty sensitive and they can change pretty rapidly. All right. Also, his theory involved judging interest rates on the basis of whether they're likely to, or let's see, explaining interest rates on the basis of whether they're likely to rise or fall. It's sort of a bootstrap way of explaining how interest rates go. Who was it? Dennis Robertson that made a criticism of Keynes, cribbing from Alice in Wonderland, I think, Lewis Carroll. And he says, according to Keynes, I think Keynes actually accepted this explanation, the interest rate is what it is because people expect it to be other than what it is. And if they didn't expect it to be other than what it is, there's nothing left to explain why it is what it is. But there it exists, the grin without the cat. Okay, that's from the Lewis Carroll business. But essentially, people anticipating whether bond prices are going to rise or fall, and then determining whether they want to hold bonds or want to hold money. Okay? And that decision, well, I think they might rise, so I want to do it this way or do it that way and so on. And then that's what actually determines what the interest rate is. So the interest rate is sort of, in Keynes, is sort of living a life of its own. It's detached from any of the other parameters in the marketplace. And he thought that was one of the major faults of capitalism, movements of the interest rate, that was really a psychological phenomenon and not a market phenomenon. Okay, well, we're out of time. Good questions. Thank you.